Recorded live at Nightmare Studios in Houston, Texas, you're listening to the Genghis and Ragman Show, where two jamokes drink and rate craft beer while they chew the fat about the world of hard rock and heavy metal, followed up by one-on-one interviews with veterans and newcomers in the industry. I'm your official announcer, Joey Clams, and here to introduce themselves is tonight's special guest.
This is Bob Nalbandian from the Inside Metal and Band vs. Brand documentaries, and I give you the right to rock.
Without further ado, here are two co-hosts who are so metal they brush their teeth with steel wool. It's Genghis and Ragman.
This is Bob Nalbandian from the Inside Metal documentary series and Band vs. Brand, and you're listening to the Genghis and Ragman podcast. Horns up.
Mono Iman, the director. We don't talk to a lot of directors. We talk to a few, but not many. Yeah, this guy is an expert on metal. All right, so he will tell us all about it. So we're talking to Bob Nalbandian. Bob, how you doing?
Doing real good, Ragman. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, and I think I butchered your last name again. I'm sorry. It's a tongue twister, man.
Yeah, it is. A lot of people get it wrong, but Nalbandian.
Nalbandian. I got it now. Nalbandian.
There you go.
So, Bob, thanks for joining us. I want to congratulate you on your latest film, documentary, Band vs. Brand. That thing is awesome. Big fan of that, man.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, Ragman. Or Alan.
How's the reception been to it so far? I know why I did you. I guess you premiered it at NAMM, right, this year?
Yeah, we premiered it. I was very fortunate to have a good friend, Pat Gesualdo, who does the Hall of Heavy Metal History Award Show. Fantastic award ceremony that they, this was their third year running, and they always do it the day before NAMM, which is great, in Anaheim. Where the NAMM is at a hotel nearby the convention center. So you get all the artists and people that attend NAMM show coming out to this. And we did a screening just before the award show, which worked out excellent. It was perfect. And I want to thank Pat again for allowing us to do the screening at his great event. And Pat is also in the movie. And so we just did the one screening this year, and then it came out about a month ago, and the reception has been fantastic so far. We've been getting really, really positive reviews. We're still, kind of getting it out there on a lot of different digital outlets. It's on Amazon Prime and, available on DVD everywhere, and we're still working on a couple others. But the word's getting out there, and the reviews have been great so far, so very happy with it.
Well, I discovered you on the Inside Metal series, and that was really cool. And I really like the way you make your movies with the they're very in depth. And I like how you kind of went back to that. You were going to hitting a bunch of the real popular, major bands like on the 80s Sunset Strip. You hit some of the lesser known guys like Snow, which, of course, Carlos Gavazzo, and some of the smaller bands. Actually, it was kind of funny because you had Max Havoc in there. And I was like, I didn't think anybody knew who they were but me.
Well, I grew up in LA. I grew up in that scene, and that was something that kind of bugged me. And when I had the opportunity to do the Inside Metal series through Warren Croyle and Joe Floyd, who was in a fantastic band, Warrior.
Oh, they were awesome.
Guitar from Warrior, Fighting for the Earth. And he was the producer of the project, and they hired me to direct it. I really, we talked about it. I said, there's really never been, they were just basically talking about doing a documentary on the LA metal scene. And I kind of, talked over with them and said, there's never been a real thorough report or movie or documentary documenting the entire scene of LA from the 80s. Everyone touches up on, of course everyone knows the Guns N' Roses and the Poisons and the Motley Crues and all that, but I wanted to go way back pre-MTV, from the 70s, the Van Halen era, so to speak, the Starwood and all these clubs and all these huge bands like you mentioned, Snow, A La Carte, Smile, as well as other bands, leading up into the second movie, the LA metal scene explodes, bands that Racer X, Leatherwolf, London, Hellion, so many other bands that, everyone's touched on the Guns N' Roses and all that. So I didn't really want to go there, the latter 80s bands. I wanted to, Warrior, all these great, Malice, of course, Armored Saint. And I wanted to kind of get the whole capsule of the whole, what it was like in the whole LA area then. And we wanted to do it so thoroughly that each movie ended up being two parts, two DVDs. So, I tried cramming a 3-hour movie into one DVD, and Warren says, hey, dude, we got to make it like 75 to 90 minutes. So make it a 2-part DVD. So that's what we did. But we're happy we did it, because we wanted to really, my whole thing is, if we're going to do this series, let's do it right. And let's capture, obviously there's a lot of bands we didn't cover in it. You can only fit so much, but we really wanted to, capture that whole image of the 80s metal club scene in LA. And I think we did a pretty good job on it.
Oh, I agree. I agree. Oh, I got a question. What kind of is your background? Have you been like, more of a rock journalist or something like that? Or just a fan that said, hey, I'm going to do this? Or do you have a big, career back doing some film type stuff, and you just said, this is going to be my pet project? Or how has your career developed?
Now, actually, the Inside Metal was the first time I got into filmmaking. So I got into it relatively new, just a few years ago. I think we started at it around 2012 is when we first got into it. And I've been doing since the early 80s. That's, like I said, I grew up in Orange County, which is about a half hour or 45 minutes south of L.A., and I grew up, I'm 54 years old. So I saw all those local bands back in the day. It's funny. I was just talking to someone. It's the anniversary of Metallica's very first show ever at a club called Radio City in Anaheim back March 14th, 1982. And I was at that show. I was
one of the
people at that show. And so I was fortunate to be right in the heart of everything. I saw, Motley's early club shows, all the early Guns N' Roses, and all those bands that I've mentioned in the LA scene. A little bit too young for the Starwood, but I caught all those earlier bands, you know, Snow, A La Carte, Greg Leon, Invasion, and when they played Orange County, like, you know, Woodstock and Radio City and Concert Factory and, you know, the old Wasp shows and all that stuff. So I was right there in the heart of it. So that's why I started that. But I started doing the fanzines in the early 80s, and I knew all these bands and saw all these bands and wrote about them. And not my 1982 through 85, I did a fanzine called The Headbanger, and I covered all these the earliest shows, the very first articles on Metallica and Slayer and Armored Saint and Megadeth, and like I said, I was right there. So me and there were a handful of other magazines that did those very first shows as well, you know, including Brian Slagle before he had Metal Blade. He had a fanzine called New Heavy Metal Review. And there was Metal Mania from Ron Quintana, Metal Rendezvous from John Sternansky. So, you know, that's what it was all about, is the metal fanzines covering the underground. And I started way back in that era, early 80s, doing the whole tape trading thing and the fanzine writing. Then I worked for Roadrunner Records in the early 90s, ran their LA office for a couple years, and worked for Herb Cohen's Bizarre Straight Records. So did a little bit of stuff in the record business, did a lot of, you know, independent publicity, wrote for a lot of different major music magazines and even men's magazines throughout the 90s. So I've been doing it, but I always had my hands in the hard rock metal field. Then I started doing podcasting, you know, the Shockwaves podcast on hardradio.com, and we're actually going to start up the Shockwave Skull Sessions again. I did that through Roadrunner Records several years ago through their site, and had to put that to rest because of the movies. But we're going to start doing the Shockwaves Skull Sessions podcast up again, so which will be fun. I'm looking forward to it. So I still enjoy, being involved in the metal business.
Oh yeah, that's awesome. And I'm so jealous. I'm just a few years younger than you. I grew up in Texas, so I caught these bands as they would make it down here. But it was mainly, you know, national acts I had to wait for to see. We had our big one back when I was growing up, was a band called Hellstar. And
of course, Metal Blade.
And Sweet Savage, and of course Pantera, before you know they turned into what they turned into.
Sure. I used to get, when I was doing the Headbanger, I think wasn't their father managing them, Dimebags and
I believe so.
Father, yeah, one of them used to write me all the time, and one of the guys in the band, and they would send me the copies of the Metal Magic album and Projects in the Jungle. They even sent me the Metal Magic T-shirt, which probably worth a lot of money now. It was a jersey of Metal Maggot.
Nice.
Got rid of it years ago, but. Yeah, we used to be pen pals. I was pen pal. Jason Newsted used to contact me. Before Flotsam, he was a band called The Dogs, and he used to send tapes. And I actually went on the road with Armored Saint in like 83, 84. It was just before their Chrysalis record debut came out. And we played Arizona, and The Dogs opened up with Jason Newsted playing.
Oh, wow.
So good times, man. So yeah, I remember all that, but Texas had quite a good scene back then, from what I recall.
And yeah,
you even had the Texas Slayer, right?
Yeah, the Texas Slayer was a band called Aggressor that was really good. I don't even know whatever happened to them. I tried to look them up years ago, and I was like, oh, wow, there's not much in print because, you know, they never made it, you know, into any kind of national spotlight or anything like that. But, yeah, we had some cool bands back in the day for sure.
Yeah. I just saw an entry on Rigor Mortis.
I think they were from Dallas, right?
I believe, yeah, they were somewhere in Texas. I'm not sure exactly where, but yeah.
Well, let's talk about your movie, man. And, you know, what was your thought process going in to with this subject line? Because I really like it. I think it's striking a chord with a lot of fans of the genre to say, you know, because I've been seeing this for a long time with bands getting into alcohol. The coffee is more of a new thing, but more bands are getting into that, and they're branding, using the name of their band to sell other products rather than just music, you know, or even T-shirts.
Sure. It was a really cool project for me to get involved with, a lot different. You know, like I said, I'm new to filmmaking. I started with the Inside Metal series, and we've done three movies, as I said, two parts each of that, and we're now editing a Bay Area Inside Metal documentary, which hopefully get out before the end of the year or the first of the new year, called Bay Area Godfathers. But yes, Band versus Brand is the new movie I did, and that's through Cleopatra, and it was Cleopatra Entertainment, and it was different in the sense that it's more on the music business side, and it was something I kind of wanted to get into, and it was something I discussed with Brian Pereira, the president of Cleopatra Entertainment, and you know, it was different than, you know, the just, you know, being a fan approach to like I did the Inside Metal. I kind of want to get the business aspect, and more of an educational movie to educate a lot of the younger artists today about the importance of branding, and not just where it gets into, you know, branding your material outside music, or branding your product outside music, whether it be coffee or alcohol or what so many bands do. But you have to figure out with this day and age, with CD sales not being what they used to be, and bands not being able to rely on CD sales, you got to rely on stuff like touring, merchandising, and branding your name into different avenues, you know, as such, like you've discussed with a lot of bands getting into, you know, having their own beer or their own wine or their own coffee. You know, there's a lot of different ways to lend your name, and that's why owning the name and the trademark to the name is so important today more than ever, which a lot of bands don't realize. And that's why you're seeing so many bands fighting over the name, you know, having two different versions of bands like Great White or LA Guns or Rat or whoever. And everyone's fighting for that brand, that band name, because that's what sells product. And, you know, there's so many different aspects to the branding and the band versus brand. We get into the hologram, and we get into the publishing aspect of owning, you know, the rights to the songs and your music, which could carry over many years, and of course merchandise, and you know, it's just very important for bands to be educated and know the business end and how it comes to, it's all about the brand.
Agreed. And I think the thing that I thought was really cool about this was how you start in the beginning of talking like Tommy Dorsey and basically these people that had a name but a faceless band. So, you know, talking about, like you said, the two different factions of LA Guns or Great White or what have you. But those guys were so, or even Elvis's band. But I mean, you couldn't go on without Elvis, of course. But I mean, these guys were so interchangeable. But when you hit to the 80s and the MTV generation, that didn't apply. So now it's more like, hey, I kind of want that guy. I want to see that guy play with that band, or I'm not interested in even going.
Yeah, I think the 80s really changed it with the invent of MTV. And I think that's something Neely from the Classic Metal Show points out. You know, in the 70s, a lot of times, you know, a band like Foreigner could go out and play because they were most notable for their songs. So, you know, the new Foreigner has no original members, and Mick Jones will only maybe play certain shows with the band, but not many people know because they weren't really so much from the MTV era, as he points out in the documentary. And that's the thing, when MTV came out, you know, with the 80s bands, with Motley Crue and Rat and all these other bands, people put a face to the name. So, you know, you recognize the Tommy Lees or the Vince Neils. So if one of those members changed, you know, you would notice right away, whereas not many people, apart from maybe Mick Jones and Lou Gramm, who knows the other guys in Foreigner or some of these other bands, you know, from the 70s. They weren't as identifiable, at least visually, as they were. So I think it's easier for a lot of the 70s bands to interchange members without, you know, fans really knowing or really caring. And, you know, the bottom line is I think the fans just want to hear the bands play the way they played when they remember them. So they want to hear the hit songs played, you know, that way. And that's all a lot of them care about. So I think a lot of the newer fans don't even know or don't even care. As long as it sounds good, they're like, hey, you know, this is fine by me.
Another question I want to ask, and this is one that left me kind of reeling a little bit, was, okay, who has the biggest brand? I know John Bobois was talking about Kiss, and you almost just, they were the leaders in that. But sure. If you think about it, and you guys touched on this, was if you think about the T-shirts you see, you see Kiss shirts, but they're mainly fans, right? But you see Motorhead shirts on posers, if you want to call them that, Rolling Stones, the Ramones, people that may not so much know that much about the band or the music, but it's like, that's cool, I'm going to wear that.
Yeah, the logos are so important today, and I think now more than ever, even after these bands are dead and gone, like say Motorhead or the Ramones, the name or the brand can live on for another 30, 40, 50 years. You never know. People might be wearing Ramones shirts 50 years from today, and most of these kids that wear these shirts, they just identify with the logo. They might have seen their favorite pop stars wearing it because of the cool factor or whatever reason. Most of the kids or a lot of the kids today that wear these shirts don't know the band. They don't know the songs. They don't know. They just think it looks cool. So, you know, again, it's all about part of branding, and it's something that we emphasize is so important that the bands know their business. And even if you're like, oh, I'm in it, I'm not in it for the money. Well, somebody's going to be making money off you. You know, if you started the band and it's your band, you should be making the money rather than some merchandise company or someone's, wife of one of the artists in your band is making the money. Take control over your destiny, have control over your brand. And that's kind of the point we try to get across, is that even after the band might be split up, the brand could have a lot of value. And as you say, in the case of, Motorhead and the Ramones or even the Misfits now, and so many of these logos, or even it could even be a club like a CBGB's or whatever. I mean, it's the Rolling Stones tongue logo. These are identifiable brands that people associate with, that, you know, not just people that are into those bands, but it's become a cultural fashion statement these days. So it is so important to have control of your brand.
Oh, I agree. I agree 100%. Hey, you mentioned Neely a little bit ago. I'm a fan of the Classic Metal Show. Those guys are hilarious. But I need to know, I know y'all look for Eddie Trunk after the Heavy Metal Awards. Did Neely ever track him down to give him $100 for his lint?
No, it was funny because we were laughing about that because obviously we as I said, we showcased the Band vs. Brand movie at the Hall of Heavy Metal History Award Show, which Eddie Trunk was the host of, and he must have darted out right after the movie, because we went back behind the stage and talked to different people. We had the Reality Check TV people filming interviews and stuff, and we were looking for Eddie, and he must have darted out. So Neely didn't have a chance to meet him that night.
That's funny. Maybe
ran away from Neely. Maybe he.
You know what's funny about him is
after him.
the funny thing about that guy is, I've seen him at, and I don't know why people pay him to. I'm not banging on Eddie, but I don't know why people pay him, and I don't know why he's getting paid to just intro a band. But every time I've seen him, he'll go walk around the venue, try to peddle some books or whatever he's doing, and then when the major band comes on, he hauls ass. So I don't know if he's just got such a busy schedule or I caught a couple songs. You'll hear him on the radio. Oh, I caught a couple songs. They were kick-ass. And then that's all he does. He just hauls ass.
Yeah. Well, he does. You know, they fly him in and out to a lot of these shows. And I understand. I mean, Eddie is the voice of the generation of metal. At least, people recognize him. He was a big TV presence on VH1, obviously, with that metal show. And he gets paid good money to do these things. And he's got a good following, and he's got the credibility. So, I get that. And I don't know if I don't know about other concerts, if he stays. I know he's been on cruise ships and other stuff where he can escape. But I don't know if, he actually watches the bands after or whatever. But, I know he's married with kids. And, seeing that, sometimes you don't have the time to hang out afterwards or do your thing. And, I give it to him. The guy's got a real busy schedule, and he's a go-getter, Eddie. And he's, getting his name out there any way he can, which is great for him.
Well, Bob, I got another question, and I found this fascinating, and I don't think a lot of bands or fans think about this, but some of the bigger bands, and you guys touched on Iron Maiden and Paul Di'Anno, and same thing happened, I believe, with Kiss, with Ace Frehley and Peter Criss, that these bands take advantage of guys, I don't know, down on their luck, so to speak, but when they're at their lowest point, they're like, hey, we sell the rights to the band. I mean, you kind of feel sorry about them, and I'm sure it happens all the time, but I'm glad that you touched on that, because I don't think a lot of people think about that. You think Paul Di'Anno, wow, he's still making a killing because he was on those first two records, and then lo and behold, you hear, wow, he sold his royalties away.
Yeah, that happens a lot, and whether it be with the bands or the management, or in most cases, the record label or publishing company. That's why it's so important, as Brian Brinkerhoff states in the movie, bands got to understand their business. They have to, first and foremost, know the business. And a lot of times bands, I don't care about the business. I'm in it for the music. I'm a purist. I'm just fine and dandy. But you need to understand the business, especially the business of publishing. And the business of branding, owning your name, because that's what's so important. And when it comes to publishing, that can last a lifetime. Yeah, a lot of bands will just get bought out. If they feel, I think it was David Tedd's in the movie makes a point that Billy Squier kept his publishing, and now you're seeing all these different pop bands and hip hop bands sampling songs like The Stroke and his music being used in commercials and TV ads, and that's money. He's making money, so he's never had to go out and make a comeback, where now you see a lot of these classic rock bands, artists in their 60s that have to go out and tour because they either sold off their publishing or they weren't the main writers in their publishing, and CD sales aren't selling anymore, so they're forced to go out on tour to make a living. So, it is very important for bands to know that aspect, especially when it comes to publishing. In a case like Di'Anno or Ace and Peter, of course, bands, and like I say, record labels alike, they're gonna want to work with bands that are ignorant, because they know they could take advantage of them. And that's the key. And when it comes to, whether you're a Kiss fan or not, I mean, Gene Simmons is the greediest motherfucker around. He's going to take advantage of you, so know your business, because there's a lot of Gene Simmons out there, a lot of bands are desperate. They'll just take the easy payout. And yeah, sometimes you don't know. Sometimes that's better. If your band never amounts to anything and somebody offers you, $500,000 for your publishing, and the band ends up going nowhere, hey, you made out. But you never know if the band's going to live on forever and accumulate millions and millions of dollars, where you got a $100,000 payout and you spend it within a year, then you're screwed. So, know your business. That's what's important.
Agreed. Another topic you guys touched on, and I love how you, put everything in order with each topic you attacked. But another one I found kind of fascinating was the tribute bands. And I think it was Bjorn Englund was talking about the different factions of Dio, the Dio Disciples, and then maybe Last in Line. And I think he kind of gave a nod to Last in Line because they're putting out original music and stuff like that. But it brought me back to the Rockstar movie, where you had the Steel Dragon tribute band and you had the two rival tribute bands. I don't know if these tribute bands... I find it fascinating. Some of them make more money than the actual guys that created the music, I guess, that are in different stages of their career with, some different members and so forth. But I thought that was fascinating how you guys tackled that whole topic.
Yeah, that's a big issue now with the tribute bands. It's obviously a, a big money maker, and I think Frank Domino made that point, where some of the tribute bands are making more money than the original bands, because creativity these days, you don't have the radio play, you don't have the record labels putting, you know, CDs aren't selling, so to put out new music is more difficult than ever, even for classic rock bands. You know, when, you know, you get these classic rock bands that put out a new record, whether it be, you know, whoever, Van Halen, Def Leppard, or Deep Purple, or you know, even bands like Judas Priest, whatever, everyone wants to hear the old classics. So, because you're not getting the radio play, the radio stations aren't playing the new stuff. You know, classic rock radio or whatever they want to call themselves, not just terrestrial radio, but a lot of the satellite radio stations don't even play the new stuff. They'll play, you know, the classic stuff that everyone's familiar with. So it makes it harder than ever for not just new bands coming out, but even for, you know, older heritage or classic rock bands that have been around for years, for them to put out new material. So, you know, it comes down to merchandising and performing live. And, you know, and that's why tribute bands, you're seeing more and more tribute bands, because as, you know, we interviewed Kyle from a band called 4NR, who are a Foreigner tribute band. He says essentially, which is true, Foreigner are a tribute band. You know, there are no original members except for Mick Jones whenever he decides to go out and play with the band, you know, but he owns the name, and he's you know, and they sound great. No disrespect. I mean, Foreigner, they've got top musicians, obviously, but, you know, it's not the original guys. And, you know, you're going to see a lot more of that. You know, Kiss is talking about franchising themselves out, you know, after Gene and Paul can't play anymore. So this, you know, this stuff could last, you know, 30, 40 years after the band is dead and gone. Now you got the hologram, which could, you know, if that really takes off, you got, you know, Dio obviously going out, the Dio Disciples going out with the Dio hologram, you know, coming up. And we'll see, you know, how that goes. But I see that's going to happen a lot more in the future, you know, especially when there's not a lot of new bands out there that are capable of getting to that arena status. I think you're going to be going to arenas in the not so distant future, watching your favorite bands as a hologram.
I know. I forget. I think it was Dave Lombardo hit the point that was saying that, you know, hey, I was looking up to see it, or it may have been Neely. I think Neely mentioned it too. Was, hey, I saw it back in the day. I'm not going to go pay to see a hologram, but the guys or kids that didn't get to see the original, I guess it would be kind of a cool thing, but. Being a purist, it'd be hard for me to go see, as much as I saw Dio a lot when he was alive, for me to go see the Dio Disciples, I wouldn't spend the money for it. It'd just be too weird. You know what I'm saying? I would rather put on a DVD or a Blu-ray on my TV, yeah, and watch that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you want to see the real deal. You want to see the flesh, and I mean, that's what's so important. I've never seen a hologram like Gus G said in the movie, so it would be, you know, maybe unfair for me to make a comment or opinion without seeing it. But just to see something that's not real for me, because I've seen the real deal. Now, if I had kids or, you know, younger kids that never saw, you know, Dio or whoever live, and you want to expose them to the magic of that, you know, I could see how, you know, them going to see a hologram of a show might, you know, be beneficial, or for that, you know, them to realize the magic of what, you know, the metal music we grew up on, how cool it was compared to what's out there today. You know, it kind of goes both ways, you know. So personally, I could, it doesn't interest me, but, you know, for other people, you know, the bottom line is, it is what it is. This is where the future of technology is going, you know, whether you accept it or not. And I think there's going to be a lot more stuff, not just the hologram, but a lot more new advances in technology that's going to be superficial or artificial, you know. So, you know, be prepared.
Oh, I think you're 100% on that, Bob, for sure. And I want to go back and just real quick touch on that, the Foreigner deal. And, you know, that is a band that I would actually pay to go see, because I was such a Hurricane fan, with, or Kelly Hansen fan. And but to go see Journey with Arnel Pineda, I look at it as like a karaoke thing. Even though it's all the original guys, I don't think I'd ever pay to see them again without Perry. And I'm the same kind of the same boat with Kiss. Even though I went against my morals a little bit because I wanted my kid to see Kiss, you know, at least once or twice, just to see the stage show, even though Ace and Peter weren't there. But it's kind of weird. I don't know if you're like this, but these fine lines you pick between each band and I guess how much you love them or how much you followed them back in the day as to what you will do or pay to see these days with these different integral parts. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a purist like you. I like to see the real deal. See, you know, it's always great to see the original lineup. But, you know, a lot of cases, you know, I brought up the case with a band like Y&T. You know, Dave Menichetti is phenomenal. I'll see them any day of the week with Dave Menichetti. The three original guys in the band are dead. They're gone. You know, and Dave Menichetti, he is the leader of the band, the main songwriter, the vocalist, the guitarist. You know, and obviously, you know, the past members, Leonard Hayes, Phil Kenamar, they were crucial as well. But it was, you know, Dave Menichetti was the key person to Y&T. So for him to go out there as Y&T is completely acceptable to me. I mean, that's I'll go see them any day of the week. And a lot
Agreed.
Of people like that. And someone like a Dave Mustaine, who is Megadeth. So it's not just a matter of being one, you know, one guy or one not. It's who the member is and their contribution to that band. So it really depends. I mean, there's so many situations where artists have sadly passed away or they're too old to play and perform. So I understand you have to get new lineups. I mean, that happens. I mean, even all the time. I mean, look at, you know, Ritchie Blackmore, even at their height of fame with Rainbow, every album they had different members, you know, changing lineups, you know, left and right. So this has always been going on, you know, kind of thing. So it's a matter of opinion and perspective of what you see is, you know, I guess, legit or not, you know, and it's really the eye of the beholder. So, you know, who am I to say? And we're not questioning it in the movie. And that's the important thing about the movie. We're not saying this is good or this is bad. You know, don't see these bands. See, you know, this has got to be good. We're just laying it out there and laying out the facts of this is how it is today and the importance of branding and owning the name and all the different aspects that go along with branding, whether it's merchandising, publishing, you know, the hologram and all the stuff. It's all important tie-in. And so, you know, I don't like to say whether it's good or bad or whether I like it or not, because really my opinion doesn't matter. It's really the perspective of the person, you know. But what the point we're trying to get across is this is a reality. This is something you have to accept the changing times and what's happening. And you have to be aware of it. You know, you have to be aware of the new aspects of business and what's going on if you're going to succeed in the music and entertainment business in this day and age.
Yeah, and you guys came off as very neutral because you had several different opinions of one guy saying this, another guy saying that, you know, something different. So, no, I think they definitely came across. My last question to you, y'all hadn't touched on this, but I think for me it's been kind of a new phenomenon. And it's basically with more established bands, kind of like the ones we've been talking about. Some of these 80s or 90s bands that don't have all the original members or actually a lot of bands that end up being on Frontiers of doing free shows. So they're paying, I guess, they're getting a guarantee or something like that. And then I guess a take off the bar and then, of course, some merch. What are your thoughts on this new? I mean, it's a way to fill up arenas or not really arenas, but clubs and stuff like that. But do you have any thoughts on this new trend that I'm seeing here?
I'm not really that aware of it. I know with the casinos, they'll put on free shows. I'm living up in Northern California now, and there's a lot of different casinos and Indian casinos. And I've seen, you know, Y&T and Great White and different bands at the casinos, and they just want to bring people in to gamble. So a lot of casinos will do free shows with these artists and pay them very, very well because they know, for one, they're going to, you know, get, you know, most of the money's in drinks. You know, they're going to get drinks, or some will order dinner if they're dinner type theaters, and they'll make their money off the gambling. They want to bring people in. And a lot of, you know, these casinos, if they're outside, like in, you know, rural areas, you know, in you know, Oroville or wherever, people will drive up from the Bay Area or from Sacramento and stay at the hotel. So spend a couple hundred bucks on a hotel and party that night and see the band. So, you know, the casinos are making their money one way or another. So they're able to pay the artists, you know, their fee plus more for doing a free show. So I understand from that aspect, as far as doing arena shows for free and all that, I don't know. But if it's a club or a dinner theater where, you know, the venue makes their money outside of, you know, just the admission price, it makes sense. And it, which is a great thing, because it brings people in, you know, whether or not they're going to gamble or spend money. It's like, hey, it's a free show, you know. Oh, I mean, you know, this is a show I would pay to see, and here I'm getting as a bonus to see it free. So, hey, I'll spend, you know, $50 on drinks and whatever that I would spend on the admission price. So if it is a trend, I think it's a good trend. I think it's a way to attract people, because I think that the admission price to concerts nowadays are getting ridiculous, getting outrageous. And, you know, and on top of that, you have to pay for, you know, if you're going to buy a couple beers or whatever at $18 a pop and then spend another $30 parking or whatever, you know, it's ridiculous. So if they could counter that with doing free admission, hey, I'm all for that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, you're right, man. These concert tickets are getting crazy. But I was going to mention, I just saw YNT. I saw Last in Line, Red Dragon Cartel. I'm going to see Stryper in May at this one venue. And it's free shows. So I did talk to Chips enough about it before. Chips like, oh, man, we're getting money off the bar and we're getting our guarantee. So, you know, he wasn't too concerned, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And then one other point I do want to mention, because you guys kind of mentioned it in the movie, was I did see Red Dragon Cartel here a week or so ago. And this guy hits me during the middle of the show, and they're playing. I don't know if you've heard really what Jake's doing, but he said, I'm not going to do any Aussie or maybe one song. And this guy hits me, he goes, hey man, when are they gonna start playing the Aussie stuff? Uh-huh. I said, they're playing Spiders in the Light right now. That's an Aussie song. Oh. And his face dropped. He was, I guess, looking for Bark at the Moon or Shot sure. in the Dark or something like that. But it was kind of funny that I mean, of course the name's gonna draw and you're gonna want to see that guy play, but I really love Jake's approach to say, this is my band, this is Red Dragon Cartel, this isn't Ozzy, this isn't Badlands, and I'm going to focus on this material here, and if you like it, come, if you don't, see you later.
I think that's great, and I give him kudos for doing that, because so many bands, they're going to want to play the popular songs, because that's what the kids are going to know. And I would have expected, I haven't seen Red Dragon Cartel, but I would have expected that they would play Bark at the Moon, because that was his most famous song with Ozzy during his era playing with the band. But the fact that he's not, I think it's kind of cool, and playing stuff that Ozzy would never play live. And I give him props for that, because most bands, you know, they capitalize on what made them big, you know, those one hits, you know, and a lot of people might go see that might not be familiar with Jake from his other bands like Badlands that only know him from Ozzy. I'm sure there's a lot of fans that'll go there just to hear Bark at the Moon or some of the stuff he did on Ultimate Sin or whatever. And, you know, they might be disappointed, but as you say, you know, screw them if they're not. It's, you know, Jake is, this is my band and I'm going to do what I want. So, yeah, I definitely respect that and admire that.
Me as well. Well, Bob, before we let you go today, is there anything you'd like to tell your fans out there?
Well, yeah, Band vs. Brand, it's available now on DVD. You could get it, you could order it through Amazon, Walmart.com, BarnesandNoble.com, all the different sites out there. It's available on digital, Amazon Prime. It's free for Prime members. You could stream it live today. and Google Play, I believe, and if there's a few other outlets out there that it's on Vudu. You could get it. So definitely check it out. Just Google it, Band vs. Brand, Band versus Brand, and please support it and check it out and write a review, and hope you guys enjoy it.
Well, Bob, we want to thank you for coming on the RightToRock.com and the Genghis and Ragman show. And just like Bob said, go grab Band versus Brand out now on DVD. This thing's awesome. It gives you a really good insight into the industry and much more. Well, Bob, it's awesome talking to you, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show with us.
You too, Ragman. I appreciate it.
Ragman, and you've been listening to the Right to Rock podcast, and we appreciate you listening, and we want to give a big thank you to Tracy G, who is the third unofficial member of the group. We appreciate all of his work, especially the Broken Man song, which is the theme song to the Right to Rock podcast.
And also, we're going to give high props to our boys in Sonic X, Adam and Joseph, have lent us 13 to finish the show, so what you're listening to right now is 13 by Sonic X. So check them out and keep checking us out. And horns up.